Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Daniel Paris. I am host of New Books in Finance, a channel of the New Books Network. I am delighted to have as my guest today, Tim Kohler. He is the author, along with Mark Goodhart and David Wessels, of Valuation, Measuring and Managing the Value of Companies. This is the seventh edition of this book. It's just come out from Wiley, first published in 1990. A new version available now. Tim, thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Thank you, Daniel. I'm happy to be here.
There aren't many books that go through seven editions. As a historian myself who works in the capital markets, I just couldn't resist the notion of going through the history of this and asking you to highlight what you see as the key changes, not between six and seven necessarily, and just an effort to support sales, but really from one through seven, not every line item, but the main arc of trajectory, the audience changes, the emphasis changes, and how you've seen this experiment work out over a 30-year period.
Well, thank you, Daniel. The probably worth sort of stepping back to why we wrote the book in the first place. Back in the late 1980s, the world of finance was in some ways similar to today, where back then we had what were called corporate raiders who were going after undermanaged companies. Now we have activist investors who sort of do the same thing. Back then, the raiders would actually try to take over the company and then change what the company was doing. And as a consulting firm, we felt it was important for McKinsey to be involved in those important strategic decisions for our clients as to sort of how to deal with raiders. And valuation is an important part of that. How much is a company worth? How do you maximize value? So that's when we started our corporate finance practice. And when we started to do this, we realized that there wasn't sort of a standard way of doing things. And we wanted all our consultants to be doing the financial analysis and the valuation the same way. There wasn't a book that did that to our satisfaction. So we decided to write an internal handbook for McKinsey consultants. It was in a three-ring binder. And that's what we did to get started. Someone suggested that we show it to some publishers. They liked it. So we turned it into a real book. And that's how it all got started. What's interesting is if you look at the first edition and the seventh edition, the underlying principles have not changed at all. Ultimately, and that's because they go beyond 30 years. Ultimately, the value of a company, as is the value of any investment, is a function of the cash flows that it generates. And the nice thing about a company is that you can disaggregate those cash flows into how fast a company is growing, its revenue growth, and what kind of return on capital it earns. So that carries out, that concept carries through all the editions. The other concept that carries through all the editions is that what ultimately matters is the long-term value creation for a company. You can fool the market by pumping up your earnings in the short term, But in the end, we think companies should focus on value creation for the long term. And that's a theme that's become much more popular these days. But we've been talking about that ever since. What's changed in the book over the 30 years is, one is we try to always make the book relevant to the historical context. So right now in the book, for example, there is a new chapter on ESG, which is an important topic that, you know, with the Business Roundtable making its pronouncement last year. There's a chapter on digital. Companies are trying to figure out, well, what does digital mean for them? What should they be doing? There is some more information on more thoughts on corporate purpose and how that relates to value creation. And then finally, one of the frustrations that many large companies have, or many companies of any size, is their inability to translate strategy into action through adequate resource allocation in terms of where do they actually put their spending. They don't. The planning systems typically don't get it, put it in the right places, and it creates a lot of frustration. So we've reflected a lot of that based on our consulting work and our research in the new book. In addition to that, there's always changes in accounting rules and tax rules that we have to reflect. And finally, we find that, you know, we want to have case studies. Or the book is full of case studies, and you know, people can enjoy a case that's a little more recent than something that's 30 years old. So we're always updating the cases to make them more relevant, what's going on in the world. And there's a lot of numerical analysis, statistical analysis, where we use to back up our points, and we update that every time as well. So the fundamentals stay the same. The cases, the examples, the external environment, those are all the things that change with each edition.
So, you know, it's very clear on pretty much on every page that throughout you have planted the flag. And as you said, constants through the 30 years, and those constants, which I want to highlight again, you mentioned them, but the incremental ROIC plus growth on one hand, and then kind of a second constant is how you measure that. It's a robust ECF with a double check with something called economic profit, which we can get to in a moment. And they are constants throughout. What was fascinating to me, and again, I'm a practitioner in the field as well, and I am bombarded with valuation metrics and determinations of what is important all the time by vendors and by companies themselves. And, you know, I have to laugh that, you know, if you torture the statistics enough, you can get them to confess to anything. You have, as you said, been kind of tried and true on incremental ROIC and growth. You do highlight other, you know, measure or generators of value and why they might be second best to yours. But I think in a world, particularly the public equity world, but also just general corporate world, where there are so many potential measures of value, I think it's worth, without getting too much into the math, and I do want to tell readers, although, you know, there's an appendix with a lot of formulas, the actual text itself goes pretty smoothly. And this is for a book on corporate valuation that's many hundreds of pages long. It is relatively lightly written, so I congratulate you and your co-authors on that. And it is not formula heavy. There are formulas, but it is not formula heavy. But let's circle back on why incremental ROIC, positive ROIC plus growth is the message that you're communicating to your clients as the key driver of value compared to so many other concepts that statistically can be generated and are every day, certainly on Wall Street and to some extent even on corporate Main Street.
Yes, well, the alternative that most people point to is some measure of earnings, right? Whether it's net income or earnings per share or EBITDA, and they look at saying, well, the company creates value by how fast they grow their earnings by any of those measures. And what we show in the book, and this is just math, is that different companies have to invest different amounts of capital back into the business in order to achieve that earnings growth. So you'll have, let me just give you an example of two companies that we can compare. If you had invested a dollar in Costco 20 years ago, or a dollar in Brown-Forman is the owner of Jack Daniels. That dollar over about a 20-year period would have grown, if you add together share price appreciation plus dividends to about $19. So both investments would have paid off the same if you're a shareholder. And yet Costco grew at about 50% faster rate than Brown-Forman. And yet the value creation is the same. And the reason that the value creation is the same is because Brown-Forman, because of its strong brand names, earns about a 30% return on capital, while Costco earns a low teens return on capital. So Costco is a company that's growing at a very fast rate, about 11% a year over that period of time. So very healthy. But because it earns about a 12 or 13% return on capital, the way the math works is that you have to put a lot of that earnings back into the business in order to achieve that growth. Brown-Forman, on the other hand, growing at a low rate and earning a very high return on capital, doesn't have to reinvest very much. And as a result, the two companies, relative to their starting point, both of them generate about the same amount of cash flow over that period of time. And that's why they create approximately the same amount of value. So it really boils down to the mathematics of cash flows. And that, you know, mathematically, we can show that it's the combination of the incremental return on capital and the growth rate of the company that ultimately drives those cash flows. And that's also
over longer measurement.
Pardon me?
Over longer measurement periods.
Over a long period of time. Yeah, obviously over a long period of time, yes. And that's also why earnings by itself is not a sufficient measure. Because if I know a company's earnings or its earnings growth, but I don't know its return on capital, I don't know how much it has to invest in order to achieve that earnings growth. And you can easily see situations where companies are growing earnings but aren't creating a lot of value because they have to invest so much capital to achieve that. And in fact, if you think about two common concepts, you know, people often talk about growth stocks and value stocks, right? As if growth stocks grow, you would think that growth stocks would grow faster. When in fact, if you look, you'll find that most growth companies that are classified as growth stocks, while some of them are growing faster, some of them have modest growth, but very high returns on capital. And the reason is that growth stocks are often classified as growth stocks because they have high price earnings ratios or high market to book ratios. And a company can have a high price earnings ratio or a high market to book ratio, either because it's growing fast or because it earns a high return on capital or both. That's why you see a lot of consumer packaged goods companies with very modest growth, but very high returns on capital showing up because they show up as in the growth index. Surprisingly,
this is dated,
they're not growing very fast.
Dated information, but when I was working my way through the thickets of the industry, the tobacco companies were often in the growth industries. And it's not because it's exactly for the reason that you were describing. Their returns on capital were extraordinarily high, exactly, even as their revenue declined 5 to 10% a year.
Exactly. But they had a high PE ratio because they had such a high return on capital. And that's how they ended up in the growth index.
So here you have kind of an assertion, and I'll phrase it my words, not yours, an assertion of a truth, of a fundamental truth, at least based on your perspective and reasonably thought out over a 30-year period and with a lot of data behind it to argue it. And it's a communication that you make to your clients regularly. This is how they should think about this. And then we run smack dab into the real world. And it's chaos out there in terms of how companies are valued. And you have, you know, by dint of experience or just observation, made a point, and it's on pretty much every page of this book, about the reason this truth is perhaps underappreciated and needs to be reminded to corporate and clients and customers is the battle with near-termism. And all of the intellectual impediments to the clarity or truth that you're proposing, it's overwhelming. You almost have to find this needle in a haystack that you're offering, and the haystack is filled with the clutter, the noise of the market every single day. And so you are engaged in quite a struggle to push this notion through to your customers. At least that's how it feels upon reading this book, that it is, you know, three steps forward, two and three quarter steps back, because the temptations for near-termism, for using near-term TSR for boosting earnings through share purchase, repurchases, and any other trick of the trade, excess leverage and so forth, is constantly confronting the clarity that you're trying to offer. It seems almost like it seems very frustrating for you to have to go to this battle every single day.
Well, on the one hand, it is frustrating, exactly as you laid out, because of the other ideas that are out there. Although over 30 years, I've seen an enormous change in the way companies think. I've seen enormous change in the way bankers think and when they talk to their companies. Not every banker, but a lot more of them talk about discounted cash flows or talk about return on capital. Return on capital has become a much more important concept that companies have adopted, bankers have adopted. Other consulting firms do the same, talk about the same kind of things. If you look at our competitors, they may call things different names, but they're essentially doing exactly the same thing. So it has come a long ways. That said, I still face these battles. You know, I still face situations where a client says, you know, a banker came to them and said, you know, if you do a share repurchase, your EPS will go up and therefore your share price will go up. Simply because of that. And even if there's no fundamental change in the performance of the business. So we do still face that. So it is at the same time frustrating, but on the other hand, it is rewarding. I'm really lucky in that I show up to a new client meeting, you know, a large company recently, for example, and the CEO remembered using the book in business school. I show up to a meeting and with a new client that I've never met before, and there's five people in the room, at least one of them has used our book somewhere in the last 30 years, right? I went to do a presentation in Hong Kong 2 years ago, and someone showed up with a copy of the first edition and to get me to sign it, okay? You know, we're very lucky in that the impact that the book has had. And so I'm proud of the fact that we've had, you know, given how hard it is to change people's behaviors and perceptions, particularly when people's, you know, built in sort of biases that they've been, you know, following for a long time. I think we've made a lot of progress over the 30 years in convincing companies to focus on return on capital and growth as the key drivers of value.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I have no doubt, because again, it sort of seems like the gold standard. You do work for a firm that has a certain cachet as well. That and I do recall going through the various training programs and running across this. Unfortunately, I do not have my earlier version with me. You know, it's a point I think you make in the introduction, but it's worth pointing out. We are engaged in an art that is at most 130 years old. Mm-hmm. You referenced Marshall, 1890. I started with him some work that I did. And you go through briefly some of the other mid-20th century developments in the work of valuation, defining the value, particularly of corporations. But striking to me that, you know, for call it several thousand years, you probably know Bill Goldsmith at Yale, call it 3,000 or 4,000 years of recorded economic activity, including a lot of what we consider modern finance, that the codification of value is 130 years old if you start with Alfred Marshall, or even younger if you start with in the early 20th century, Irving Fisher or so forth. And so, you know, these are exercises that have been occurring to some extent for thousands of years, but we only have these guideposts now. And so you're in the, I would say from a historical perspective, still in the building stages and this is an early stage exercise of creating guidelines for people to think about, even though it's been going on for 30 years.
Yes, that's correct. But we are making progress. So that's
progress.
That's a good part about it. So,
and I think you're really going to get to the tipping point in the next 30 years. I think for volume, what it'll be? It'll be the 14th edition. I think it's going to finally push you over the top. There is a lot, and I'm sure this was not in the first edition. There's a fairly robust criticism or discussion of shareholder capitalism as opposed to stakeholder capitalism. And I'm surmising that's not really in some of the earlier versions. And it's very topical right now. And you very timely fashion managed to put a number of chapters in there that deal with these issues, particularly digitalization and ESG. Mm-hmm. You want to comment on those specificities? As you comment, the book came out in the period of the classic raiders, your version one. This version is coming out in the period where the shift from shareholder capitalism to stakeholder capitalism and how that might play out in the numbers and in the valuation exercise. I think that's a really important point.
Mm-hmm. Well, first off, I think it's an interesting little tidbit is that one of my early mentors was in the New York office of McKinsey was Dutch, and the Dutch system of corporate governance has always been stakeholder oriented. And the second edition of the book, I actually wrote as I was transitioning from New York to the Amsterdam office, right? And so I spent the late 90s in Europe. Looking at and experiencing how people thought about it there. So there was already the debate in Europe before there was a debate in the US. So we did actually reflect it much earlier on because this debate was happening in Europe, and Europe was, for McKinsey, was almost as big as it was in the US. So mm-hmm. it was an important issue for us way back then as well. And so we began to talk about it a little bit in the first, more in the second and third edition. But now this issue of stakeholder versus shareholder clearly has come into the forefront. It's in the news. It's in the more popular press all the time now. When we look at it, though, we find that we have to distinguish between, is there a conflict between shareholders and stakeholders? Or is there a conflict between creating value for the long-term investors or the short-term investors? And I think when you define it, when you look at it from that element, it's very easy for a company to fool the market in the short term, right? Because the market has, investors have a limited amount of information. Plenty of ways that a company can goose up their earnings for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, right? And get their share price to go up, right? And that may satisfy some of the short-term investors. But if you're doing that by skimping on product development or reducing product quality or not doing enough branding work or whatever, eventually people will notice that, right? Your customers in particular will notice that. If you don't treat your suppliers right, people will notice that, and it will make it more difficult when you want to renegotiate. So what we have found is that for the most part, companies that satisfy their stakeholders, particularly their customers, their employees, and their suppliers, do a much better job in creating value over the longer term. Plenty of examples of companies that have not done those things. Plenty of examples of companies that have taken shortcuts on safety, for example, in order to save a few dollars. And it blows up on them sometimes literally a couple of years later, right? Companies that take shortcuts on the environment, and it'll come back to haunt them later on. So the conflict is not as stark as it's often presented, right? It is starker if you say, well, I want to maximize today's share price for a group of investors who are going to be in and out of the shares versus I want to maximize my share price for those shareholders who will be in it for the next 3, 4, 5 years, right? I have to make a choice as a manager. I can't do both, right? And so we would argue that you're always going to have shareholders, so better focus on the ones who own it for the longer term or who will be buying it later on for the longer term. Focus on those longer term shareholders. That will then generally lead you to focus on innovation, product quality, customer service, happy employees, good relationships with suppliers in order to get there. And of course, good relations with regulators and a good safety record. All those things are important. Now, there are some situations where that rule doesn't necessarily work. The question is, how much profit should a company earn? Should a company that is able to charge a very good premium for its products? We've talked about this in this edition or the last edition. A company like Apple Computer with the iPhone, they charge a premium product for that, right? Premium price for the product, and their satisfied customers are willing to pay that premium price. Now the question is, if you say, well, we should try to satisfy all of your stakeholders, what is the right price? Now, economic theory says if you're trying to satisfy your shareholders, you set the price at the amount that maximizes your revenues or your profits, right? And your customers will be happy and your shareholders will be happy as well. Now, they could lower the price. Their customers might be happier, but should they lower the price? And if so, how much should they lower it? So there's no guidepost unless you have a long-term shareholder value creation perspective. Should you pay your employees more than competitive wages? All these kinds of difficult questions aren't answered by the shareholder versus stakeholder debate. If you took it to an extreme and said, we're only going to earn our cost of capital and anything above our cost of capital as a company, we're going to give it back to our employees, to our customers, to our suppliers, that company probably wouldn't attract any capital. And by the way, it wouldn't attract very talented management. It wouldn't be innovative, et cetera. So you do have to have some opportunities for the shareholders to create value for the shareholders in order to encourage innovation, in order to encourage risk-taking, in order to keep the best employees happy, the best talent happy. And that also leads typically to more satisfied customers and more satisfied suppliers and a better situation for the community as well.
We're back really to this, as I mentioned, it's kind of on every page because I think it belongs on every page, is the battling, I think you referred to it as the treadmill in regard to the stock market, but the battle with near-termism. Yeah. Let me ask you, based on your practice and on both this book, but also your ongoing practice of trying to communicate this type of management strategy, publicly traded companies are structurally at a disadvantage to try to do what you're doing. Privately held companies have a greater shot at doing it. Have you empirically observed that the privately held companies get closer to your ideal of management than publicly traded ones because of the near-termism that is just endemic to the public markets?
That's a good way of putting it. And I would argue that there are public companies that are long-term oriented, that are private companies that are short-term oriented. It really depends, right? Although we have done one of my colleagues has done some research working with private equity owned companies and found that the managers of private equity owned companies would say that they're allowed to do things that they don't think that they could do if they were publicly listed, things that are complex to explain or a little longer term oriented, right? So there is some truth to that. On the other hand, I've seen privately owned companies that are very short-term oriented because they've got the wrong kind of private equity owner. So not all private equity owners are the same.
I think we should, for the audience's sake, distinguish between private equity, which is a leveraged leveraged buyout restructure 5 years and out, and small P, small E, perhaps family-controlled companies or just stable private ownership, which could be in it for decades. because in many ways, I don't consider private equity to be long-term at all. They are out of sight, but they have a time horizon, which isn't much longer than that of the public markets. So I think it's almost public equity on one hand, along with, and again, this is unfair, but I'm going to go with it anyhow, private equity writ large, both together in the short-termism camp, and then privately held businesses, maybe family, but privately held businesses that have the luxury of long-term strategic planning. Yeah. Is that a little bit too cartoonish?
Well, in a way, I would have thought that as well until I started doing some work for some family-owned businesses. And what I discovered is it often depends on what generation of the family you're talking about, right? The founders tend to be much more long-term oriented, but some of the bigger companies that have been around for generations, where the family isn't as involved anymore, even though it's long-term capital, the behavior tends to be short-term oriented. Partly because it's not that the capital isn't patient; it's that the board of directors just doesn't know enough to judge the management team, which is not family members, based on anything other than the short-term results. And so we see bad behavior and good behavior regardless of the forms of ownership. I remember talking to an executive in the UK who had been the CEO of one of the largest public companies in the UK. He was also the CEO of a company that was owned by a private equity firm. And he said, well, as a listed company, I had a series of 5 1-year plans. And as a private equity owned company, it was 1 5-year plan, right? And I could do things, you know, what mattered is where I got to over 5 years, as opposed to what I did in the first year, right? And so I'm reluctant to, there is certainly a fair amount of truth to your characterization, but there are enough exceptions that, you know, you don't want to sort of automatically assume that all family-owned companies are long-term oriented and all private equity firm companies are short-term oriented, and that all publicly held companies are short-term oriented. Although I am disappointed oftentimes when I, you know, work with some publicly listed companies at the decisions that they make and their focus, because they believe that they have to satisfy what they call the market, right? And what they don't realize is that we did some back of the envelope numbers. In a typical U.S. large company, about 75% of the investors are long-term oriented. You've got the retail investors who are pretty much buy and hold. You've got the index funds and about half of the institutional investors. And then you've got 25% of the investors who are the shorter term head, you know, the trading oriented funds, right? But they're the ones who make all the noise, right? They're the ones who ask all the questions on the quarterly calls, or their representatives, the sell side analysts do. So sometimes managers, I find, get the perception that they represent the market, but they don't represent the market. One of the things we try to do sometimes is to link up company managements and boards with sophisticated long-term institutional investors and sit down and have them talk about what's important to these long-term investors, to these institutional investors. And we've done surveys and we've done statistical analysis. We did a survey of long-term institutional investors. And these are big name firms that are very sophisticated. They've got fairly, but their holdings tend to be long-term. We said, well, what's important? What's not important? What was not important at the lower end of the scale was meeting or beating the consensus EPS, right? They think that that can be a bad habit for companies. And we've talked to them and we've interviewed them about this, right?
You refer to this as the treadmill in your book about once a company gets onto that treadmill, it actually becomes very, very hard to get off of it. And you're playing and losing an expectations game because you have to avoid each time you beat expectations, you raise expectations for the next quarter. And it just ends in tears almost all the time.
Yeah. But what we find is that that these investors understand that there are forces outside of your control that will affect your earnings that you shouldn't necessarily try to control. Take currency rates. A typical, let's say, U.S. pharmaceutical company, or maybe a better example would be a a consumer packaged goods company or beverage company.
That's based in Atlanta and makes fizzy drinks and only has about a quarter of its revenues in North America.
A lot of, you know, a lot of these companies generate, you know, 60, 70, 80% of their profits outside the U.S., right? And
exactly.
One of the things that happens is that exchange rates change, right? They have no control over exchange rates. Exchange one year, they'll go one way, they're going to go the next, right? When you talk to investors, sophisticated investors, they understand that management doesn't control and can't predict interest rate exchange rates, and they don't want management to worry about that. They evaluate, they tend to focus on their evaluation on a constant currency basis, for example. And so they're gonna say, well, yeah, if the exchange rate moves against you, maybe the share price is going to be a little bit lower, but we don't expect you as a management team to have been able to forecast that. And we don't want you to try to take actions because we know you can't forecast it, right? So we're just going to ride with that volatility, right? We're okay with that volatility because over the long term, we believe in the business model. We believe that you'll be able to earn a high return on capital and achieve a certain amount of growth. So what's not good is when companies take heroic actions to meet the consensus earnings that hurt them in the longer term.
Selling a building at the end of the quarter is a classic one. We see that all the time.
One story I heard that was,
go tell your story.
One fascinating one was that there was a company that had a big operation in, this is a number of years back in Russia. It was doing extremely well. Russia invaded the Ukraine. And there were sanctions imposed at the same around the same time oil prices fell. So the Russia business declined considerably in a very short period of time, in a period of a couple of months. Their reaction to this was to cut their spending in Southeast Asia, which is one of their hottest growth markets, right, in order to meet their short-term earnings targets. And whenever I've mentioned that story to investors, they all sort of shake their head and think, this is crazy, right? Take your medicine. You know, you couldn't have controlled what happened to Russia, right? But you know, don't cut your investment in Southeast Asia because that's the future. And you know, this company was cutting, you know, was under the wrong impression that the market would react mechanically to the short-term earnings and not look at try to understand what was going on and what was driving them and what was good and what was bad, what was under their control and what wasn't. And led to decisions that, you know, ultimately will hurt them over the time because they will lose market share in Southeast Asia because they're not investing enough.
In the interest of full disclosure, because we didn't really discuss this before we started recording, I have to tell you, I basically am one of those investors that is a long-term, or at least tries to be, and has little reaction to quarterly results, but often feels compelled to communicate to the companies after the quarterly results saying, hey, you know, listen to the call, all that's fine, but you know, it's not what's motivating us. We do have our eye on the long term, and we just remind the companies that we're there. We're on the shareholder list, but we're not necessarily on the calls. We're not at the conferences. We're not jostling for one-on-ones because we are trying to maintain that long-term focus. But as you correctly say, the management just has the hedge funds are buzzing around their ears, and that's all they hear or see. So we do try to periodically get in front of the companies and just say, hey, let's take a deep breath. We're also a shareholder. By the way, we're a shareholder for a very long period of time. And it is probably, not always, but probably the case that what the hedge fund is telling you that we would take the opposite view. So just so you know, we're here.
One of the things that we do quite regularly is meet with management teams to talk about their investors and their investor communications. We also meet with whenever our clients have a new CEO or a new CFO, we'll often sit down with them to talk about, you know, concepts in the book and other concepts about what it's like to be a new CEO or a new CFO. And one of the things that I always tell the new CEOs and new CFOs about working with investors, find 10 to 15 of your top long-term investors like you, right? And develop relationships with them, right? Tell your story to them, listen to them. And if you do that, it'll give you more courage to make the long-term decisions. But you have to force yourself to reach out to the investors, to listen to those investors, Because if you're passive and you just listen to read the sell side reports or listen to people who call you up, you'll get the wrong impression about who's out there and what matters to them. So you have to be proactive as a CFO and the CEO in reaching out to investors and understanding which ones matter and what they're thinking and not what the noisier ones are thinking.
Amen to that. Again, we're on the same, I'm disturbed that we're on the same side of an issue. So let's get back to something we can disagree on. In the remaining few minutes, I just want to highlight, you know, there is a lot of, so the first, call it half of the book, it raises a lot of big issues concerning valuation and approach. So roughly speaking, the second half of the book gets to the practicalities of how you do it. It's almost like a manager's handbook of thinking about projects, financing, and there are chapters on taxation and currency and leverage and all sorts of things. One of the most striking, which I think would surprise even readers not involved in finance, and if there are any readers not in finance listening at 38 minutes and 25 seconds of this interview on a textbook on valuation, we applaud you. One of the great points that you make, however, and I've observed, is that the financial statements which public companies produce and which effectively private companies of any size also produce and which are highly regulated according to generally accepted accounting principles, are actually, you know, they are also subjective and they are were chosen and agreed upon by some board of wise people at some point in time. But in order to get to where you like to be in terms of ROIC plus growth and proper DCF and economic value calculation, kind of the nuts and bolts of what you do, you actually have to restate much of the financial statements. I think that's a kind of a surprise. People would assume that if a financial statement exists, it's probably a good thing. But I thought it quite fascinating that the extent to which you basically want everyone to start all over again. Maybe that's too strongly stated, but they have to make a lot of adjustments to the financial statements. Without getting too much into the weeds, though, can you just comment on this notion that, you know, the documents is presented to you, the investor or the manager, may not be the documents that you actually need to make the best long-term decision?
Mm-hmm. That is correct. You have to take them apart. And we find that the longer-term investors, the more sophisticated ones, are doing the same thing. They're taking apart and really understanding and crafting those financial statements into something we would consider to be more economically representative. And what we typically mean by that is separating out the operating from the non-operating and the pure accounting things from those things which really affect cash flows. And the rewarding thing, though, about this, it is still frustrating that we make all these adjustments, right? But over the 30 years, some of the adjustments that we've made, we don't have to make anymore because the accounting rules have moved in the direction that we've been advocating for a long time. Mm-hmm. Most recently has been the capitalization of operating leases, which is something that we have been doing. And by the way, the credit rating agencies have been doing it forever as well for the entire 30 years that we've had this book out there, right? It's an asset that you're using and it's a debt when you enter into an operating lease. One of the things that we've been advocating for a long time is when it comes to defined benefit pension plans is to really separate out the components of income and expense that are operating versus non-operating. A lot of the volatility, I know one company that, you know, from year to year, their earnings would go up or down by more than 10% because of changes in the valuation of the pension liabilities, which had nothing to do with the operations of the business. And finally, what that company started to do was issue non-GAAP statements, right, where they adjusted for those things. And now the accounting bodies have changed their rules so that the pension expenses it effectively is separated into an operating and a non-operating component. Especially IASB is much more consistent with this than FASB. But the accounting rules have begun to change. A couple of years back, we did a quick look. I looked at the top 50 companies in the U.S. by size, and almost every single one of them issued some kind of non-GAAP reporting, because the GAAP reporting just isn't that useful to investors the way it's done right now. So it's kind of a sad state where the decision makers you know, aren't really looking at what the companies and investors are doing, right? They're saying we're coming up with these theoretical rules, but no one is using the financial statements as they are presented. They're, everyone is making adjustments.
And some of those adjustments are more negative than others. That is, you're referring to positive adjustments. But there are plenty of adjustments that are made that our companies are kind of distorting their near-term results to make them look better as well.
Sometimes. But what we found is that, and I remember talking to years ago, one of the internet, when there was a debate about whether stock options should be expensed. And I remember one of the top securities analysts who covered internet stocks said, I don't really care whether you expense them or not. As long as you give me the information, I'm going to look at it the way I want to look at it. And a lot of sophisticated investors are that way. They're going to create their own, you know, just give them, whether you put the information on the face of the income statement or the balance sheet or put it in the footnotes, they don't care. They're going to figure it out. Right. And so, you know, that's essentially what we've ended up with is a situation where, you know, there are these accounting rules, people have to follow them, but people more and more, the communication between investors and companies is much more on a non-GAAP basis.
So, you know, you've spent, and it's 500-600 pages, 700 pages of laying out these guidelines in the book, and in a structured sort of empirical pattern. It's not all formulas, it's not all difficult formulas, but pretty, you know, firmly stated guidelines that are mathematical or empirical in nature. And working against the noise of the market, working against financial statements that aren't structured to communicate that, among many other challenges as well. But you end what I thought was a fascinating note, and it highlights more the strategy end rather than the accounting end. As hard as you and maybe others in a less sophisticated manner trying to get to some sort of empirical truth, You do point out, and it's kind of core to a strategy consulting business, at the end of the day, you're going to be making some subjective choices in strategy. However much you dress them up in data, it can be hard. You're going to be making choices, decision-making under conditions of uncertainty. Absolutely. And the metaphor that you use is, you know, do you bet on the horse or do you bet on the jockey? Do you bet on the business or the leader? And one without the other creates risk, but sometimes you like the leader, you don't like the business. Sometimes you like the business, you're not so certain about the leader. And you know, business people are forced to make choices when they have imperfect information, even if they have a really well detailed 700 page, really comprehensive guide to decision making. At the end of the day, it comes to a highly subjective choice. Is that an unfair statement?
Not at all. I think there's a lot of attempts at false precision, right? When I'm concerned about it, with a company's cost return on capital, I don't care whether it's 13 or 13 and a half. I care whether it's 13 or 25, right? A lot of this is still trying, while we do try to get good measurements of particularly historical performance, right? We realize that there's limits on what the numbers can tell you. So we want order of magnitude. But also we have to, it's about the future as well. And so the fundamental question is, you know, are those, why is a company able to generate that return on capital and that growth? And what does that mean for the future? Does it have the products that are going to be attractive going forward? Is it investing enough in product development? Does it have a good cost structure relative to its peers? And it's going to be able to earn have a good cost per unit so that it can make a good profit on each unit. All those things you have to ask about, you know, from a qualitative perspective as well. The numbers are helpful because, but forcing you to put themselves down, sometimes it's often better to do it the other way around even, right? What do you have to believe to come up with a certain valuation is another technique that we can use. Because you're right, there is no one can predict the future. And so it is about using the numbers more as a way to think about the possibilities and come up with a consistent set of forward looking and see what the implications are before you in order to help you make decisions.
I think Yogi Berra got that, something about the difficulty of forecasting, especially about the future. You do have, by the way, a chapter on trying to make that very subjective art a little bit more digestible and so forth. The book is Valuation. It's the 7th edition, Measuring and Managing the Value of Companies. Tim Kohler, thank you so much for being my guest. This is it's an expensive book. It has a list price of $95. However, if you think about, as a manager or an investor, the stakes that are involved in getting these questions right or wrong, the issues that are raised in the book are worth, frankly, a great deal more than that. So thank you very much. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Daniel. I've enjoyed the conversation quite a bit.
As have I.